If you haven't already, explore the many ways to connect with our show. Watch full uncut conversations on YouTube, gain AIA-approved continuing education credits through Arcademy, and make sure to check us out and follow us on social media at Detailed Podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
They happen to have these massive, really long span wooden beams from old palaces, you know, of Venice. And it was just sort of this light bulb moment. And we just thought, this is what we need to use. And the price was right also for using that. And the same company could shape them in the forms we wanted and do all the work themselves. And they were based in Venice. And it was sort of perfect. You know, the way I like to think about it is that some of those would 200 years old. So for me, this pavilion is actually an antique. It's a 200-year-old antique that we made anew. And I love that idea.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guest today, and I might say, one of my absolute favorite interviews this year, is Miriam Asufu, founder and principal at Miriam Asufu Architects, with offices in New York, Niamey, Niger, and Zurich. Miriam Asufu is an architect from Niger. She is the founder and principal of Miriam Asufu Architects, a research-led architectural practice with offices in Niamey, New York, and Zurich. She is a full professor of architecture heritage and sustainability at ETH Zurich. The project we're talking about today is the Rolex Pavilion in Venice, Italy. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. The 2025 Rolex Pavilion is conceived as an architectural exploration of place, material, and time, situating sustainability not as an add-on, but as the project's primary design driver. Embedded within the Venetian context, the pavilion draws its formal and spatial logic directly from the city itself, an island bifurcated by the Grand Canal, translating this geography into a sinuous divided plan that organizes circulation and exhibition space for the 19th International Architecture Exhibition.
So the client for this project is Rolex. And as you know, Rolex is the official sponsor of the Venice Architecture Biennale. And they were really interested in having a new pavilion in the Giardini area, like of the Biennale, and they, for the first time, decided to outsource that. You know, normally, they develop their pavilions in-house, and they decided to outsource it because they were interested in a pavilion that explored the idea and concepts around sustainability. And I've had a long-standing relationship with Rolex, going through different projects and programs they sponsor, and so we had a conversation where we discussed what it could be, what a sustainable pavilion could be, what I could imagine, how I could think through it. And it was just such a fruitful conversation on the onset. I mean, the nice thing is that the pavilion is always in the same spot. There's a platform that is there normally, and you have to basically make a pavilion that fits a certain predetermined footprint on top of this slab that is always there. So the boundaries were very clear, and it was kind of straightforward. And they were interested in having a series of exhibitions inside the pavilion. I think my role at the beginning was mostly to design the pavilion, and they were going to take care of the exhibitions inside. But as we were working through the concept, they also decided that they wanted us to design the scenography also and design the full exhibition within to ensure that it was in symbiosis with the design of the pavilion itself.
The exhibition is presented in collaboration with Rolex's Mentor Protégé program, reflecting the brand's longstanding commitment to sustainability, an ethos closely aligned with Miriam's own history and practice.
One opportunity during the Architecture Biennale that Rolex always tried to seize is, and I was actually a recipient of that, is that it's an opportunity for them to showcase their Mentor Protégé program in their perpetual arts initiatives. I used to be a protégé of the Rolex Mentor Protégé program years and years ago. And what they do at the beginning of the Biennale is that they would showcase the project that the protégé worked on with their mentor during the course of a year or 2 years. So that was the primary sort of content they were looking to showcase in the pavilion. The other content was also that they had been designing or developing these new stores in other parts of the world, notably in Milan and in Tokyo, which were very much anchored in the idea of sustainability, but also in the idea of craft making expertise that is disappearing, you know, nowadays. And there was really a symbiotic line of thought between my practice and this particular desire they had of showcasing these stores.
Miriam Isufu Architects' design philosophy in all their projects threads a specific outlook on sustainability, which is as much cultural and economic as it is material or environmental.
I think I stumbled on this almost accidentally, and I think it's sort of a byproduct of practicing on the African continent where there's a huge amount of scarcity, and the question was always, how can you make more with less? You know, how can you make incredible buildings that are energy efficient for the simple reason that energy is incredibly expensive in most parts of the African continent? So for very pragmatic reasons, how can you make architecture more affordable? Again, for the simple reason that when you make architecture that is following a sort of normative Western model, it tends to come at a premium in a place like that, where the materials involved would probably need to be imported. The technical skills required might also need to be imported in order to execute the project of its ability. And so I started thinking about architecture fundamentally in its inception, from a construction point of view, and the construction implications of our choices, our material choices, our form, the forms we make, all of those things have a very direct cost implication and sort of viability implication at the end of the day. So that led to developing a practice where I thought about sustainability through those different lenses, and realizing that when I look at it through an economic lens, through a cultural lens, through a material culture lens, it lends and it brings me sort of effortlessly to a really, really high level of environmental sustainability. Because when we're talking about using materials that are local, for instance, which is, you know, one way of making buildings more affordable because you avoid transportation costs and import duties and things of that nature. And also you make the buildings more maintainable long term. So you're also thinking about the life cycle and the time the building needs to be able to operate effectively. All of a sudden, making a building that is affordable has a environmental benefit. The materials are often sourced from maybe 5 to 10 kilometers of our site. At least that was the experience in Niger, or at the very least, you know, nearby, or at least within the same country, which is something that at this point in our globalized economy is almost unheard of, right? We're just thinking about where we can source whatever material we've already designed into a project, rather than my approach, which is a reversed approach, where I first go and really excavate, you know, all the different skills, materials, traditions that are present and inherent to a certain context to figure out what the opportunities are from a design point of view. And I design based on those so that by the time the building is designed, it can already be made with local skills, local materials, which inherently is what I call economic sustainability, because you are empowering local workforces, you are empowering local skills and injecting funds back into a local economy before the building has even arrived. You have already provided a level of value in the context. And so that economic sustainability is incredibly important. But of course, then that means that you pollute less. You pollute less through your material choice because it tends to be a natural material that is, you know, inherent to that geography. And you've provided work for people who are there locally. And that also translates into a certain level of sustainability, because usually when we look at local skills and local materials, that means that they have a certain history in that context of being used a certain way. And it makes it also easier to find local collaborators, you know, who could be involved. So that is tied to this notion of economic sustainability.
Formally restrained, yet materially expressive, the pavilion is defined by a carefully articulated envelope that balances opacity and permeability. The pavilion's steel frame is fully recyclable and bolted rather than welded, allowing for disassembly and reuse beyond the Biennale. Within this armature, 200-year-old timber beams salvaged from Venetian palazzi are repurposed as wall elements.
I think by the time we worked on this project, it was very easy to lend to these materials because, again, we now have a systematized way of researching before we embark on a project. And so it started with me spending a few days in Venice with a list of traditional makers that I just decided to just go around and visit in their workshops. First, we were looking through all the different practices that are really much entrenched in Venice. So it's glassmaking, of course, is you know, comes first and foremost, woodworking, ceramics, all kinds of different practices, and singling out the ones that we thought would be useful, you know, for a pavilion, and then just going through and spending, you know, hours with these incredibly open and generous with their time, you know, makers and practitioners in the city who welcomed me in their workshops and sort of walked me through their processes, because that is very important, the thinking and design process, to really understand actually how, even down to the kinds of tools they have available, so that once I'm imagining different designs, I can tell right away who can make them based on the people I met and interviewed and the kinds of practices I witnessed. So that's how it started. And, you know, came down to wood and glass quite quickly. I mean, glass was a given, definitely, because it was Venice. I hesitated between stone and wood at some point, but it being a pavilion, you know, wood was just much more practical. And at the beginning, I was very much interested. I discovered that a lot of the rotten bricolets, and they call, you know, those pillars that are inside the lagoon, were being repurposed by some of the practitioners I spoke to who were turning them into, you know, other sort of artistic. And I thought that would be incredible to be able to use that as cladding material, actually. And for the longest time, that's what we were going to use, and because this is essentially discarded material. And we were going to sort of sand it, you know, and turn it into this facade, this wood facade. Unfortunately, that ended up costing three times more than even sourcing new wood. So we went back and discovered a company who did sort of this incredible work of cataloging and storing materials from dismantled or sort of damaged buildings in Venice. And they happen to have these massive, really long span wooden beams from old palaces, you know, of Venice. And it was just sort of this light bulb moment. And we just thought, this is what we need to use. And the price was right also for using that. And the same company could shape them in the forms we wanted and do all the work themselves. And they were based in Venice. And it was sort of perfect.
Win, win, win.
Exactly. Checked the box for the wood. But similarly for the glass, you know, the glass was problematic because choosing a glass maker was the biggest issue. There's so many of them. They're so incredibly talented. It was sort of painful. It was a painful process. But in the end, we went with Vistosi because they had a sort of controlled environment that was very useful to create sort of standardized pieces. And they already had a working relationship with Rolex, and they already were very familiar with the level of quality that would be required, et cetera, et cetera. So it just sort of made it easy from that point of view, and time was very short. So they were the perfect partner to help us streamline the process of the glass that ended up being in the project as well.
I love now that I know that pavilion's built out of wood from palaces. That just makes it all the more special in my mind.
You know, the way I like to think about it is that some of those would be 200 years old. So for me, this pavilion is actually an antique. It's a 200-year-old antique that we've made anew. And I love that idea.
Venetian glassmakers Vistosi produced circular glass discs that composed the ceiling plane, echoing the language of foliage above while filtering daylight into the interior. The floor plane reinforces this material continuity. Terrazzo surfaces incorporate recycled Murano glass shards as aggregate, grounding the pavilion in Venice's glassmaking legacy while transforming waste into architectural finish.
Because it's a family business also, they're so incredibly open. You know, I spend a lot of time in their factory, which I'm calling it a factory because it's very standardized, but everything is done by hand. You know, the glass is blown by hand. You know, it was just sort of absolutely amazing to watch them work. And it was quite effortless, I have to say. You know, they were, and with every artisan and maker we worked with, they all were very excited. They love what they do. None of them approach their craft like a business per se. We all became nerds together, collectively, you know, as just sort of trying out different ideas, you know, one. And this is also what I cherish. And that was one of the pleasant surprises for me, because when I work on the continent, it was always very much like that, you know, working with other makers and practitioners, and they would get very excited because all of a sudden we are making things that they know how to make, but they've never quite made in that form before. And they would get super involved in trying to solve it and to figure out how to design, you know, how to create the thing we designed. And it would be incredibly fruitful, but most importantly, just a very sort of excited energy. And it was the exact same energy in Venice. So that was also incredible to realize how universal this was. Because at the end of the day, it was really about a conversation. All of the conversations were about their craft. My design is one thing. But what I was really interested in was what they were making and how they were making it. And we could just speak for hours, you know, about the different processes we would employ, and just so many back and forth. We would receive these material samples in our New York office, you know, in 24 hours, and then we would get on a Zoom call. You know, there was just something incredibly liberating, you know, also about that process. I was inspired by some of the things I saw in the workshops. And this is why this kind of preliminary research is so important, and why I don't pick up a pencil until I've done this research. So I started seeing, you know, it started with the texture of the glass, you know, sort of kind of the dapple surface of the glass sort of started making me think about light and how the light would shine through it. At that point, I did not think that I would make a roof out of the glass. I was just sort of letting it through. But the dapple nature of the glass is what led me to want to use it as a roof element. Because one of the things from the site is that while it's sort of this little space, you know, on this platform, it had these mature trees all around it that created this incredible canopy. And I remember standing there and looking up at the trees and watching the light filter through the trees. And so when I was in Vistosi's offices, they had glass samples that had this sort of same dappled nature. And that's where that idea came from, you know, to some extent.
Internally, ceiling, walls, and floor operate as a cohesive material system, each element carrying cultural memory while participating in a closed-loop approach to construction.
The pavilion is formed as basically two different pieces that interlock, and that was inspired by, is actually from the aerial view of Venice, which looks like two hands that are sort of interlaced together and sort of divided by the Grand Canal in that way. So the pavilion comes together as these two pieces that are kind of semi, almost triangular, that come together to make one continuous space. And sort of the circulation, then it's sort of like the Grand Canal, you know, in a way. So it's a little bit cheesy, you know, from that point of view. But I thought it was, you know, I thought it actually worked quite well from a spatial organization point of view, because what those two different pieces allowed me to do was actually very simply programmatic separation. So I could create a zone for the Rolex content related to the stores and the exhibition for the stores, and a zone related to the exhibition architecture protege whose work was going to be showcased in the pavilion as well. So it was really sort of a purely functional, pragmatic point of view, as well as being sort of this tongue-in-cheek nod at the plan of Venice. And so when you're inside, because the project had this has this incredible glass ceiling, all the natural light, you know, is coming through the glass ceiling, which allowed me to create a completely opaque skin all around, because I was very much interested in creating an immersive experience. So when you enter, you're surrounded by the wood, you know, that continues inside. And you have this dappled light that's filled in through the ceiling, which is completely sort of colored discs from beginning to end, you know, everywhere, which obviously then colors the interior, you know, with this kind of like slight green tinge. But depending on the time of day, depending on whether it's a sunny day or overcast, the atmosphere is completely different. And it ended up being also, and this I did not intend, but I was very satisfied to witness it when I was on site. It was a refuge, because I made sure that there was also seating inside, because one of my frustrations in the previous pavilion was that there was no place to sit. There was seating inside because there was a lot of video content also to absorb. So I witnessed that, because the Biennale can be quite overwhelming, you know, there's so many people, so many exhibitions, people started going into the pavilion almost as a point of a place of respite. So they would sit there, they would walk around, but then they would at some point sit there, you know, they're just on their phone or they're going through some brochure. They would go outside, sit on the steps we have outside the pavilion, and then go back in again. And several people mentioned this to me also, having visited it, how people would go in and out, back and forth in the pavilion, but it would also linger. And I think for pavilions, that's something that you don't necessarily get, the lingering. You enter, content the exhibitions, and you continue to on to the next pavilion. So my only intent had been to create this immersive, you know, experience, and to also dampen noise with the wood. The wood was very, very successfully did that. But I did not think about the psychological impact actually of being overwhelmed by the Biennale and how that could be something of a refuge from the chaos.
The project reflects an intersectional approach to sustainability that extends beyond environmental considerations. All aspects of the pavilion were produced and upcycled locally in Italy, particularly Venice, or recycled from other projects, ensuring that the social, cultural, and economic fabric of the region is actively supported.
So the wood, all of the wood, the glass by default, you know, can be transformed at will. You can be melted back down, make new glass. So it's sustainable from that point of view. And it's sustainable because it's been sourced literally just from right across the lagoon and fabricated there. So that's also the other layer. And when we started thinking about the floor, for example, I was very much interested in making terrazzo tiles, and I wanted to embed glass in the terrazzo tiles. So then we found just basically discarded glass that these manufacturers were melting back down. You know, it was basically trash that they melted back down added pigment in and created these massive charts that could then be used to make objects. A lot of artists use them. A lot of the glass that you might buy in Murano that is very colorful embeds some of that glass. And so I just decided to have it crushed and turned into aggregate for our terrazzo. We had to go through many different, you know, samples, you know, and different tries, but it worked out. So that was also sort of repurposing essentially unwanted material into, you know, this incredible tradition, going back to cultural sustainability, tradition of terrazzo, you know, making in Venice. And then we had to design a metal frame because the glass was so incredibly heavy that we had to have a pretty robust armature to hold it up. But the metal, we made sure was recycled metal and that it could be dismantled and recyclable. So nothing is soldered in. Everything is bolted in the pavilion so that it can be dismantled and reused. So one of the conversations we had, even with the contractor, who is also a furniture maker. So that inspired another sustainability idea where I designed the different pieces in such a way that they can be dismantled so the individual glass discs can just be detached and they can become tabletops. They can become, you know, all kinds of different objects, you know, later on. Similarly for the wood, it can also be dismantled and detached, cut to different shapes. It can end up becoming new surfaces for credenzas, you know, for table legs, all kinds of different things. So I also designed the individual pieces and sort of how the pavilion would come together by thinking through also how it would be dismantled and how it could be repurposed.
By fostering the project in a thoughtful design phase that inherently involved collaboration with local artisans at an early stage, project challenges were successfully circumvented and avoided.
I don't think there was a design challenge per se, to be honest, because a lot of the design ideas were born of either the place or the people I encountered and the practices I encountered. So there were just association of ideas that happened sort of effortlessly. And again, because, and that's why I find this process so valuable, because it was so anchored in who will end up making it and in what it was, you know, inherently from a material point of view, that many things just sort of fell into place. I think the only challenge, which was not that big of a challenge, was just more of an annoyance, was the amount of metal that we had to use for the armature of the pavilion. That was unsatisfying for me, let's put it that way, just to support the sheer weight of the glass, right? But I also did not want to compromise, you know, on that glass. So, you know, sort of it was, I had to make a choice from that point of view. But we were also working, and again, this goes back to what it means to collaborate with local intelligences. Things happen quite easily because of it. Because otherwise, what we're doing is we're designing a project, we're deciding what's going to be on it, then we're hoping we can find someone who can execute it the way we want to. And we have a lot of headache, you know, controlling and going over the things that are not quite the way we meant them to be, et cetera. And because this was not something that I could afford to do, again, when I was building or when I am building on the continent, because again, the skills are not the same, I had to develop a system where things could happen very easily and where construction would be as uneventful as possible and where construction could be as straightforward as possible. That also meant designing in an incredibly restrained manner. How can you create beauty and functionality and sort of even adventure, you know, sometimes, but turn it into a system that can be dumbed down and that could be easily put together? And I did the same thing, you know, for this project. And again, because the people putting it together are the local experts, it just, they could do this with their eyes closed. We didn't have to worry about if the glass was going to come out, you know, the way we wanted. We didn't have to worry about whether the wood was going to be, you know, sort of cut and planed the way we wanted. We didn't have to worry about whether the contractor was going to be able to put together this design properly, because also the contractor just like us, was a big believer in process. You know, we had a one-to-one mock-ups of the pavilion before we actually went on site. So when we went on site, it just came together in weeks, very quickly. So I think it's about systems.
For Miriam, the pavilion's integrated ecosystem, materially and culturally shaped and elevated by the local community, is a defining aspect of the project, one that rises to the forefront and merits careful documentation.
The building, when it's finished, is just sort of the conclusion. For me, that's never the end goal. It's just the conclusion. It's the end of the process. But the whole thing matters. From the minute we start researching all the way to the building delivery, to me, that is the architecture. It's not the building alone. It's the whole thing. Because again, with this approach we have, because we inject back in the local, you know, ecosystem, then that means that that is also the project. And I find that incredibly important. The idea that a project is not just a building. It's also the constellation of people, the constellation of, you know, skills and know-how, the lives that have been shaped by it, especially if you, again, embed it in a local community, then if it's not anchored in the community, then that cannot be part of the project by default. But when it's anchored in the community, that then, you know, encounters this project as part of their life, then the whole process is the project. And I love that. And I think also the other aspect of it is that, you know, because the people we collaborate with are specialists, right? So it's also not the kind of community involvement that we think of often where, especially in the so-called global South, when we're thinking that, you know, we should encourage people to build themselves, you know, or something like that. These are experts, you know, and I think expertise is something that should be respected. And what I always imagine is also the experts whose hands made, you know, certain aspects of these buildings also being acknowledged by the people using, you know, that project, right? So in the Rolex Pavilion, one thing that I really insisted on is that we document the process of their work and we turned it into a film that is screened on the hour, every hour in the pavilion. So when you sit, you will encounter it. That is important. You know, that's also part of the project from my point of view. So we could actually hear in their own words, you know, what their craft means to them, how they, what they thought of the process of going, of working through this project specifically, what they found challenging, what they found less challenging. There was just sort of a certain amount of also like the pride which shined through, you know, in the work they were doing and it being giving space and place to express itself.
The design ethos for this project matured and was further honed to focus on future projects.
What it did, it allowed me to really generalize this approach. I think it was a lot more specific before, a lot more sort of anchored to a certain part of the world. And working through this project, and it wasn't the first time I was going through this process outside of the continent. But I think it was the first time I was able to do it because the project was small at such an intimate level. And I was able to do it from every single point of view. So it became a laboratory for these ideas, for refining these ideas, and for really strengthening them and clarifying them even for myself.
The Rolex Pavilion represents a precise architectural proposition. A sustainable structure deeply rooted in context, constructed through reuse and collaboration, and shaped by an understanding of architecture as a medium for continuity between past and present, craft and innovation, permanence and impermanence. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what advice Miriam would offer a younger architect on best practices and the most important things to consider when working in a new country.
One thing that concerns me from an architectural practice point of view is that sometimes when we go to other places, we just import ourselves into those places. And that can be fine, but that can also have some really sort of negative consequences on the context, because architecture is never neutral, right? So my advice would be to sort of take a back seat for a little bit of time when you actually enter that space, to soak up as much as you can, and to learn from people who are actually operating from that space, rather than seeing yourself as the expert that has come into this space. I think, of course, this is important, you know, as sort of like a humility, you know, measure. But actually, I think it leads us to better and maybe even richer design. Because for better or for worse, I think architecture and architecture education has a very sort of unique and sort of specific point of view and specific ways of thinking about things and doing things. So I see going to another geography as an opportunity to not only challenge that, but add new tools to your arsenal. There is always the opportunity for that. There's such an incredible richness, you know, everywhere, which we've kind of flattened, you know, by making this globalized architecture, which is so unfortunate because it's so impoverishing from a design and from an imagination point of view, you know. Actually opening yourself up to other ways, learning from other ways, from older ways, you know, also is something that I find incredibly important as an inspiration source, as a grounding sort of practice. Because at the end of the day, as much as we like to feel like we're inventing new things, we never invent anything. You know, technology is amazing and we should harness it for everything that it has to offer. But many problems that we try to solve, you know, in an innovative manner have already been solved before. And sometimes we just kind of have to get over ourselves.
I can't even tell you how much I enjoyed this conversation with Miriam. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
I grew up in a part of the world that is considered, and I say considered, one of the poorest, that was colonized and shaped by that colonization, that was at times even designed by someone else. And I think what that did was sort of give me a drive to approach architecture, or frankly, life in general, in the way, the things I think about, from sort of a deep design for equity, respect, dignity. Because when you grow up where I grew up, those are the things that are consistently stripped off of you. At least you always feel forces that are stripping that off of you, either because they're defining you, they're explaining you, they're showing you. There's very little agency, at least that you feel you can have. And all I hope is make a contribution towards thinking through ways in which you can reclaim agency, reclaim dignity. And this is, again, I think something that's very universal. And coming from where I come from made me very sensitive to that. But I think actually this is something that you can feel in New York, and you can feel, you know, in London, or, you know, in Beijing. These are emotions that, as human beings, these are realities that we often encounter. It's just that where I come from, it's like at a very kind of systemic level. But to your point, this is something that you can feel also on the individual level. And all I hope is to be able to contribute towards, you know, solutions that take us in a different direction, and solutions that empower and dignify. And if I'm able to do that, then I can rest in peace.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around RCAT.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.